Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Mary Robson for Nature Now. In the week leading up to the August 21st solar eclipse, and if you're not aware of that, you may have been living in a cave or underground. Last week's brilliant painted full moons, which were colored by smoke in the atmosphere, just led up to this week's anticipation. Solar eclipses occur with the new moon. A clock on the NASA website is counting down the time to the arrival of the eclipse on the coast of Oregon. Just go to NASA and then click on Eclipse. They have a lot of information. And we will offer some observations, but first, the mystery sound. Observations today, Craig Weir is going to help me. He will be talking with us about lichens later on, but for the moment, he's going to do some observations.
So the first observation is survival of moss that have been buried under ice for 400 years or more. Samples of moss released by a melting glacier revived to life when planted. The process showed is cryptobiosis, described as a state between life and death. All metabolic activity disappears. This is not the same as dormancy, in which metabolic life continues. Carbon dating put the mosses at over 500 years old. No live stems were present. Some specimens regrew, some did not. Life under extremes has been studied in a number of ways. Mosses pressed and dried in herbariums have been revived after decades. Also, mosses and lichens subjected to absolute zero, minus 273 degrees centigrade, have revived after 2 hours at that temperature. But no previous experience with moss recovered such an age ago has been described.
And you said that there were other things that have been tried with lichen?
Yes, with lichen. They survived in outer space, hanging on the outside of the International Space Station, for 180 days. And when they returned them to Earth, more than 70% of them were still viable and reproduced.
They must have had them secluded in some sort of a container that would take the motion they were, because they were moving the whole time, right? So you can't just hang it out like a flag. You've got to protect it in some way.
Yes. They were in kind of containers, but they weren't protected from the radiation in any way, and they didn't have any buffers against the changes in heat and cold.
And so the next observation, Craig?
Buzz pollination. Bumblebees pollinate tomatoes. Honeybees cannot. Bumblebees produce a strong vibrational buzz that helps release pollen. Tomato flowers protect pollen by concealing it in a tube-shaped anther with minute slits along it. The bumblebee rapidly moves flight muscles to shake the pollen loose, and this bee is capable of moving these muscles without flying. Tomatoes can self-pollinate through wind, but better results occur when bumblebees or other native bees arrive. Protect those native bees.
And that was described in the New York Times, August 10th. Well, I had a butterfly sighting, and this is a butterfly whose name, his actual name, is Red Admirable. Five of them were nectaring on marjoram flowers in my garden. This is a brightly colored butterfly, deep brown, circled with orange, and the tips of the wings have a triangle of black with white spots. It's a common butterfly throughout the temperate northern hemisphere. And describing this butterfly allows me to cheer about a fascinating guidebook, The Butterflies of Cascadia by Robert Michael Pyle. The common name of this butterfly, which is about an inch and a half across, Red Admirable, is over 250 years old, and it is often misstated as Red Admiral from the look of the tips of the wings as if it had the insignia of an admiral on it. This butterfly lays eggs on stinging nettle, and after noting this, Pyle weaves some history into his writing, which he often does, as well as poetry. He notes, Sir Winston Churchill struggled with his estate gardeners to keep nettles for this butterfly. Onward to a few thoughts about the eclipse. I'm starting with a poem. This is Emily Dickinson, who saw an eclipse on September 29th, 1875. And this is what she wrote. "It sounded as if the streets were running, and then the streets stood still. Eclipse was all we could see at the window, and awe was all we could feel." The woman who edited Emily Dickinson's poems, whose name was Susan Loomis Todd, was an astronomer also, and she wrote a book called Total Eclipses of the Sun, published in 1894. She had done a lot of traveling with her husband, who was also an astronomer, and apparently was one of the many people in the world completely captivated by total eclipses of the sun. This was noted in a publication that comes once a week called Brain Pickings Online. It's by Maria Popova. So what about this eclipse? This will be the first solar eclipse in the continental United States in 38 years. The last one occurred, some of you may have seen it, February 26th, 1979. Nan Evans of Nature Now saw it, and she'll probably have something to say about it next week. Its path went through the edge of Washington and across only five northwest states. It moved out at North Dakota, went across Canada, and across Greenland. In 1918, the eclipse crossed the continental United States. This is why people are saying, oh, this hasn't happened for 99 years. This 2017 solar eclipse is the first since then to cover so much of the U.S. Everyone in the continental United States will see at least a partial eclipse. It is estimated to be 48% coverage at the northern tip of Maine. Port Townsend is going to see about 92% of the sun covered. And observers have remarked, well, this doesn't provide the awe connected with totality, but surely it will be fascinating. And seeing this happen in your own neighborhood, that's rare. One source I read said you have to wait 365 years for the eclipse to happen in your own vicinity. So start waiting. Finally, why is totality so short? It's because the moon's shadow is moving, and it's moving fast. The longest totality period in the August 21st event is 2 minutes 40 seconds. That will be in Illinois. And Nature Now team has a special announcement. We are very interested in hearing from listeners about what you observe in the natural world during the solar eclipse. Will you see changes in bird behavior during the sudden dark period, or your chickens? Quieting of insects? Even if you do not observe any responses, that's information too. Please email us at naturenow@kptz.org and let us know where you were during the eclipse and what you observed. The week after the solar eclipse, we will share these observations. Craig Weir is with us today to talk about discovering lichens. This is the third lichen show I have done in the past 3 years, and each time new revelations come along about these intriguing organisms. Craig Weir taught college and worked with high-tech business before retiring to Port Townsend. He's been studying lichens intensely for several years and brings a spirit of curiosity to everything he observes. So, Craig, you said you started the way I did discovering lichens, on a trail in the Olympics.
That's correct. We moved to Port Townsend from Orcas Island about 10 years ago, and it's through my hiking on the wonderful trails that populate the Olympic Mountains that I was inspired to an interest in plant life, which I'd never particularly had before. The things I saw walking along the trails, particularly things that grew on stumps and logs and the trunks of trees, and there was such a variety of things. When I started to try to figure out what I was looking at, I went to everyone's handbook, Pojar and McKinnon, Plants of the Pacific Northwest Coast. And he mentions some lichens, but he only talks about 35 different lichens in his book, and there are over 1,500 lichens in the Pacific Northwest, so it's a pretty small sample.
So if you know five lichens, then you have five minus 1,500 to go. I'm good on five of them.
Right.
Why aren't these classified as plants?
Because they don't have a vascular system. They don't have roots, and they don't move water up and down their stem.
Which moss does, right? To a degree.
To a degree, yeah.
Moss, I think, is classified as a plant, although it's a different type of plant. Is it a bryophyte?
It's bryophyte.
And so the thing about lichen is they are completely independent of what we expect plants to be doing, namely cuddling down into the earth and drawing up what they need.
They are indeed.
They have to get what they need from the air?
They do. And they have a companion that they live with. They don't live alone. They all live with a companion. They're a combination of a fungus, and most of what you see when you see a lichen is a component that's constructed by the fungal portion of the lichen. And then it has either a algae or a cyanobacteria. And if you went to college a few years ago, they used to call cyanobacteria blue-green algae.
Because they didn't know it was a bacteria.
That's right. They thought it was an algae.
Which, actually, I think I'm trying to think of one of them, for instance, Lobaria oregana, which stays in the tops of old-growth trees, mm-hmm. has all three of those elements.
Yes, it does.
In it, and it is one of the ones that fixes nitrogen.
Correct.
Okay.
And it's the bacterial component that does the nitrogen fixation.
Okay, which is quite amazing because we think of nitrogen as being fixed by plants like legumes that are peas.
Right.
And in this case, lichens, non-plants, incredible entities are able to fix nitrogen and grow themselves into some amazing shapes. Mm. So, and the shapes have names, which sometimes it's easy to get tangled about.
They do. They have a lot of common names people know them by.
That's so fun.
Things like pixie cups, British soldiers, old man's beard. But they also have scientific names. And the name in common use can vary with the geography in which you find the plant or the organism. And the scientific names follow a set of rules, and there are two names called a binomial naming system. First word specifies the genus, and the second word the species. So, for example, pixie cup lichen all belong to the genus Cladonia, but specific Cladonia, like Cladonia bellitiflora, has the common name of British soldier. We'll talk a little bit more about that later when we talk about identification of
And lichen. Sometimes that one is called Bloody British Soldiers because it has a color red on it.
It has the color red.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How do the components fit together? I mean, we were talking about the fungal component seems to form the outer shape. The algal component provides food. And then what makes them all such different shapes? Do we know?
Well, it's very interesting. The activities that are engaged on in lichen are not predictable by the components. The algae don't do any of the shapes that you see in the mature lichen, and other mushrooms, other fungi, have very different shapes as well. And in fact, what happens when they combine is they actually, through mechanisms that are ill understood, they actually produce different biochemicals than either one of the organisms can produce on their own, and their distribution geographically. Lichen live in places where fungi and algae don't live, and they're distributed all the way from the Antarctic to the Arctic, and they live in deserts, and they live in rainforests. They live probably on your fence.
Or your roof.
Your roof.
And yeah. I have seen pictures of them on old shirts left in the woods.
Sure.
Automobiles. If you have a desiccated automobile, it probably has lichen on it. Which might be a good time to talk a little bit about how they reproduce. Because if you were noting that they can grow and be symbiotic with their various parts in places where the individuals aren't necessarily. So how does this organism spread itself around?
Well, there are two methods. One is unique to the fungal portion, and that's the production of spores. And when those spores are released into the environment, they can't reproduce a lichen. They can only reproduce the fungal component of the lichen. In order to become lichenized, as the lichenologists say, they have to find a algae or a cyanobacteria of the right kind and be in the right habitat, and then lichenization can take place. But because lichen grows so slowly, they're very difficult to study in the laboratory. Some lichen have been measured over time, and gravestones are a great place to look for lichen and to study the age of lichen, because a couple of things happen with gravestones. They have a date on them. You know when they were erected. And thus, when you see a lichen, you know when it started growing there. And you can make a measurement and see what it is now, and come back in 10 years and measure it again, and come back 10 years later and measure it again.
But the human lifespan does not exceed that of some lichen at all.
I mean, that's correct.
Right. You have to pass the research on to the next person in the lab. I have seen some gravestones in Maine where the people manage, and some of these are 17th century, or, well, I would say 18th century, and the person maintaining the grave area occasionally scrapes the lichen off because they just want to have it be more tidy. And that leaves a shadow of a lichen on the gravestone. So you can see where it was. But sure enough, they'll start inhabiting again.
Right.
And this might be a little piece that fell off of another gravestone and was blown on, or this is really mysterious to me, is
right.
how they do it.
That takes us back to the second way lichen reproduce. And this is called vegetative reproduction.
Okay.
Because it doesn't involve any sexual interaction between the elements of the lichen. It's because pieces break off that have both the fungal and the algae or cyanobacteria component. And indeed, lichen have devised two different strategies for creating pieces that contain some fungal cells and some algae cells or cyanobacteria that are designed to break off or to blow off of the lichen and just distribute them. And if you have both of those elements in a piece that blows off, it can grow a complete lichen from that start.
The lichens don't necessarily have to be next to a similar lichen in order to grow. You can have four different kinds on one branch.
That's correct.
Which I think is fascinating.
Yes, and there are a couple of places in town here where you can see multiple types of lichen growing in a single place.
Ah.
On the corner of Roosevelt and Jackson, right where Monroe turns slightly to the right, and then you go left onto Jackson, at 401 Roosevelt, there's a rock on this edge of the street in the driveway that has some moss on it, but it also has at least four different kinds of lichen. This is an opportunity to talk about the growth forms of lichen that we mentioned before. So there are three different growth forms: crustose, foliose, and fruticose. And crustose are lichen that grow very close to the surface. In fact, you can't move the lichen off at the surface without scraping away some of the surface that it's growing on. Mm-hmm. And the technical term for lichenologists for what the lichen grow on is substrate.
We sometimes see crustose lichens on trees also?
Yes, sometimes on trees. In fact, a second site I was going to tell people about is there is a tree right in front of the Key City Players Playhouse and Office at the end of Jackson in the parking lot there. And it has both foliose and fruticose and crustose lichens all in the same tree. There are two additional types beyond crustose of growth structure for lichen. Foliose, which are leaf-like, and they tend to be, for the most part, close to the substrate that they're growing on. They have two surfaces, so they have an external surface and a lower surface that's against the substrate. And they're often relatively flat and loosely attached to the substrate.
So it is possible to extract a piece of one. You need a hammer to get a crustose one
off.
You
do, and a chisel, yes.
But these you can gently pick up a corner and take it off and look at it if you want.
Just with a little pocket knife.
Right. Assuming that you are not in the national forest.
Correct. In addition to the foliose lichens, their third growth structure is fruticose. And these are upright or shrub-like, and sometimes they're hanging, which they call pendulous. And they often have tufts or string-like characteristics. And then there are some that are also fruticose that look like little matchsticks that have vertical stems.
Hmm.
But they're all a strong three-dimensionality. All of the fruticose ones do.
These are the ones that you're very likely to notice on trees when you're hiking. That was one of the lichen you wanted to speak about in a little more detail?
Yes. So there are a number of varieties of Usnea. That's the genus name. One that you see most often here in the Pacific Northwest, or very often, I should say, is Usnea filipendula. And its common name is fishbone beard. And it's a thallius fruticose, both tufty and pendulous, can be up to 40 centimeters long. And you see it hanging from branches, and you often see it blown off trees. You'll find sticks and limbs that maybe in your yard after we have a strong windstorm here that very frequently, even right here in town, have examples of Usnea attached to them.
I had a nest I'd mentioned to you. It was Hutton's Vireo in the top of a vine maple, that's small native maple. And I thought that a rag had blown into the top of the tree with wind. And the Hutton's Vireo is a bird that gathers up this Usnea and tucks it over the edge of the nest and then lets it hang down so that when you're looking at the nest, you don't see it. It's part of the general flow of things. So
right.
That brings us to what lichens are used for by creatures possibly other than humans.
Sure. So they're ecologically important. They provide food, shelter, and nesting materials for both large and small animals and birds. Flying squirrels, for example, winter over a brown beard lichen. It's their primary winter food. In turn, they're a significant food source for the endangered spotted owl.
So everything is connected. We wanted to get there somewhere in this talk.
Right. And in addition, other creatures familiar in this part of the world in the winter, elk and caribou eat lichen when the snow covers the ground.
They paw the snow loose to get at it?
Yes. They kind of nuzzle it away and get at it.
Just as a sort of closing comment, humans have not done very well finding ways to dine on lichen.
No, they don't eat it very much, but it's had a lot of indigenous people's medical properties that they've applied it for. And then it's also used to dye cloth.
Oh, yes. Beautiful plaids of the Scottish world before the aniline dyes were invented in the 19th century were all dyed with lichen.
That's correct.
And that's the colors are really enchanting, I have to say, as someone who knits.
Right.
They're really beautiful, and people are still doing that.
They are.
For sure. I know that they're relatively indigestible for people, but that they have been boiled, right?
Yes.
Let's not do that today.
No.
Okay. Okay. I think, I can't believe this, but we have come to the end of this half hour. Craig is working on a guidebook to local lichens, and I am looking forward to talking with you in 2 weeks about that, what's going on with it, and how where you start. All of us depend on guidebooks, but most of us are not courageous enough to start making one, so we will be talking about that.
Right. Courageous or foolish, we'll see.
Oh, no. Okay, thank you so much, Craig.
Thank you,
Mary. This has been fine. Okay. The mystery sound today was the pigeon guillemot. That is probably the English pronunciation of a French word. It is not a pigeon. It's about the size of a pigeon and roughly the shape, but it is not a pigeon. This is a seabird. It is coastal from Oregon up to the far north of Alaska. It often overwinters nearby here on the Salish Sea. There are really striking markings on this bird in its breeding colors. It is a very shiny brownish black, a pair of patent leather shoes that have just been shined, and it has a large white wing patch, which persists even when it goes into a less black period when it's not breeding. It has kind of a heathery look to the feathers. The feet and the inside of the mouth are a really bright, shiny red. They fish by diving, using their wings to help them swim. These are relatives of auks and puffins, and they absolutely depend on the ocean. Both the male and the female care for chicks, and they feed them, once they've started hatching, about 16 times a day, day and night. The young birds can swim and forage when they leave the nest. They're independent at 1 to 2 months after hatching. I think that the independence probably depends on the quality of the available food. Pigeon guillemots need healthy populations of small fish, shrimp, and other seafood. They are considered a key dweller of the Salish Sea coast, and they are intimately tied to the life and health of the sea. Now for a couple of events. August 19th. The Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society is doing a rendezvous for raptors. Check with them for more detail. It is on August 19th, starts at 2 p.m., and August 21st, when you're all interested in looking at the sky. The Port Townsend Library on Lawrence Street is going to have a solar eclipse viewing party. This will be outside, so it starts at 9 a.m., bring a chair and a blanket if you need to keep warm. And it should be quite interesting to see what the library has to say about the eclipse. So enjoy your eclipse preparations and listen here next week for Nan Evans, because she will be talking with Jonathan White about the effects of eclipse on tides, which will get you connected with how things move in the sky. We hope you have enjoyed this program of authentic and eclectic news of the natural world. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays with repeats here on KPTC on Thursdays at 5 and Saturdays at 11:30 a.m. Podcasts are also available on the website at www.kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Eclipse, performed by Pink Floyd.